Hi, thanks for joining me again, Gary Zacharias. This is the Apologist Bookshelf. I want to take a look at a book that is dealing with something that's hugely controversial in our society today and gets all sorts of reactions. A lot of hackles get raised at this. It's a book by Andrew Walker. It's called God and the Transgender Debate. And it's subtitled, What Does the Bible Actually Say About Gender Identity? Oh, what an issue, huh? Rosaria Butterfield, who was a lesbian and then became a Christian and has married and is a good author, she said, this book models how to discern the times and respond with hope. Rod Dreher, who's the author of The Benedict Option, said it's an invaluable guide for walking through the heat and confusion of this debate. You know, gender issues are just, they're in the news every day, aren't they? And they're part of everybody's lives, it seems like. So the point about this book is they're saying that the debate isn't really about a debate, it's about people. And so in the book, Andrew Walker explores what does it mean to be male and female, and how should we be thinking about views on gender? And he looks at what Jesus said. Now, Jesus certainly debated issues, but more than that, he loved people. And then Walker says, what Jesus says is good news for everyone. And so if you're interested, as it says on the back of the book here, if you want to learn more and love better and are open to considering what God has to say about sex and gender, this hope-filled book is for you. Now, who's Andrew Walker? He's the director of policy studies with the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission. And he writes regularly about ethics and public policy and the church's social witness. And you can take a look at him on Twitter at Andrew T. Walk. And so anyway, that's just a little background on it. So I'm picking a chapter out of this. It's the first time I've done this particular book. And again, it's a hard subject. It really is hard in our society. So this chapter is the sixth one. It's called Beauty and Brokenness. And he talks about how the previous chapter, he brought in Adam and Eve, and he left them at the end of that chapter living in a perfect harmony with each other and with God. And he said, of course, if the story had ended there, then you wouldn't have needed Walker's book. But he says, it's too bad. The story doesn't end in Genesis 2 with kind of a happily ever after picture of Adam and Eve. Paradise didn't stay paradise. And that's where this chapter is going. The story takes a turn in the chapter of history that's often called the Fall. And we know the story, don't we? Adam and Eve sinned. God had instructed Adam and Eve, don't eat from this one tree. Everything else was freely available. But Satan comes along and offers Eve a pathway that she gets to choose. And he promises her pleasure and enlightenment. That's seductive, isn't it, to get a choice like that, even before modern advertising? And the serpent then looks at God's rules that he had given Adam and Eve. He casts them as restrictive and unfair and petty. I mean, think about Genesis 3. What does the serpent say? God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be open and you will be like God. And we know what happened at that point. Eve ate of the tree, so did Adam. And at that time, it didn't really seem like she was going down the wrong path. I mean, hey, who wouldn't want pleasure and enlightenment? That sounds good. Her decision was rational. That was reasonable, supported by what her feelings were telling her. How could it be wrong? It seemed good, and that it just looked wonderful, and it seemed wise. And her husband, of course, shared with her. He says at that point, Walker says, isn't that our story too? We don't cast our decisions to reject what God says as the actions of rebels. We don't see ourselves that way. We're just owners and masters of ourselves. What could be so wrong? And he sums it up. This is the drama of Genesis 3. What is it? The casting off of God's rule. You can be like God in your own life, Satan says. You can have the authority. You know what's best. You can't trust God, but you can trust yourself. And guess what? Humans said, yes. Now, we still say that today, don't we? So the next section of this chapter, he calls it their story and our story. And he says, when Adam and Eve reached for that fruit that represented who was going to have authority to rule, they denied God's authority. They doubted God's knowledge. They disputed his loving goodness. They take up their own authority. Thank you very much. This was not a slip up. Eve's choice was, who's going to be Lord? she chose an alternate Lord. Now, what occurred, he points out, in the garden so long ago has made its way down to us. He goes to Romans 3. None is righteous. This is what Paul says, not one. No one understands. No one seeks for God. No one does good. There's no fear of God before their eyes. So he's pointing out that Adam and Eve's story is not disconnected from us. It is our story. That's all of our story. We can't stand in judgment over Adam and Eve saying, wow, what a terrible choice. Each day we do the same thing. We want to sit on the throne of our lives and we push God off. We all sin. We sin differently, but we all sin and we're all equal in our sin. And they said the first reaction that we got after the rejection of God, the first result was that people started feeling ashamed of and awkward about their bodies. That's interesting, isn't it? So he said the rebellion at that point did more than just shake up Adam and Eve. It affected all of creation. And he quotes from Genesis 3, and I won't quote all of that there. But the Bible shows that when sin came about, it was catastrophic. Creation was broken. The Garden of Eden had been a place where work was hard, but it was fulfilling. But now we've got a cursed world. It's full of thorns. It's full of thistles. Work is frustrating. We have floods. We've got tornadoes. We've got hurricanes. And it's all a result of a world thrown into chaos. We chose to assume God's throne, but we can't rule his creation. We break. We're dust. We're frail. We fail. There's cancer. There's depression, eating disorders, heart disease, and gender dysphoria, Walker points out. And each of these realities, he says, testifies to the brokenness of creation. And then, of course, we've got our moral failures, the Holocaust, domestic violence, neglect. Now, he said, if we think about gender dysphoria or transgenderism in a way that listens hard and humbly to God, we've got to let him tell us that this world is not now the way it was intended to be. And we need to understand that the effects of the fall are not only around us, but within us. I think that's really powerful. Alexander Solzhenitsyn said something like that, we point to others and say, there's the problem. And he said, no, it's within us as well. And he said, as you read, he said, we're going to keep going here with a promise of hope. And he said, this chapter is not the end of the book, and the fall's not the end of the story. So this chapter is going to show where the problem came from, but then the rest of the book will tell how we get out of this mess. Next section of this chapter, what happened to our hearts? He said, inside every heart there's a war, and we're both victim and culprit. And why is that? Because all of our hearts are full of sinful desires. There's an ongoing battle within the heart in which unhelpful desires are going to wage war with our conscience. We've got bitterness. We've got anger, greed, envy. We can't trust our feelings or all our passions within us because we feel them. Why? Because our hearts are not pure. And he pulls out a verse here that I've used a lot myself. It's in Jeremiah 17. The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately sick. Who can understand it? And I'll tell you, let me stop here and just interject something of my own. We hear over and over, trust your heart. Haven't we heard that a lot? A lot of movies say that. It's pop psychology. Trust your heart. Society's messed you up, but you're okay. Trust yourself. Well, no. Jeremiah 17, the heart, one more time, is deceitful above all things and desperately sick. Who can understand it? So he said, the way deception works is to convince us that our hearts won't be satisfied until we indulge what our hearts desire, but our hearts lead us astray so many times. Good point here. He says, not every impulse we experience should be indulged. We should be suspicious about listening to our hearts. Everybody knows that's true. He says, prisons are full of people who acted according to their feelings. Now, the real question is, so what desire should we be feeding and which should be starved? He says, so what does this all have to do with transgenderism? He said, in the same way that fallen desires get into the hearts of all of us, individuals with gender dysphoria experience real feelings. So he's not poo-pooing what they're feeling. He said they do have real feelings of distress about their gender identity. And he said nobody should dismiss this or belittle it or have a joke about it. He said, if you feel this way, you are experiencing real deep pain. But, and I put an exclamation next to this, because we experience that feeling, that doesn't mean that feeding it and acting upon it is best or right. Internal longing for peace doesn't mean that finding peace is possible through breaking boundaries of our human limitations and rejecting the way we've been created. And then he uses a statistic here, and I put a double mark on this. It's a little reported fact, he says, that people who undergo sex reassignment surgery do not statistically report higher levels of happiness after the surgery. Yeah, I've read that myself. In fact, people have a high rate of suicide, even in countries like Sweden, for example, where they're not being condemned by their society, they're actually being encouraged. So one more time, let me repeat that. He said, not many people realize that those who undergo sex reassignment surgery, so they're actually changing their sex surgically, they do not statistically report higher levels of happiness. Well, what's going on there? He said, well, look at Genesis 1 to 3 again, the worldview there. Bible says that if you embrace a desire that's at odds with the Creator's design, it's not going to bring you ultimate happiness. Now, he pauses at this point. He's got another little section here that he says, he calls it gender dysphoria is not sinful. He said, we need to pause. We've got to make a distinction between the experience of feeling and acting on a feeling. See, I think that's a really good point. It says, individuals who experience gender dysphoria are not sinning when they have that experience. To feel that your body is one sex and yourself is a different gender, that's not sinful. The Bible nowhere says unwanted psychological distress is sinful in itself. It's a sign that we're broken by sin. But, he says, when you decide to let that feeling rule, to feed that feeling, that is sinful because it's deciding your feelings are going to have authority over you. God's not going to have authority, your feelings will. He said, when our hearts get hardened, when we decided to shove God aside, our minds are affected too. He goes to Ephesians 4, you must no longer walk as the Gentiles do in the futility of their minds. They are darkened in their understanding, alienated from the life of God because of the ignorance that's in them due to the hardness of heart. So Walker points out that without God, if you don't have God in the picture, your reason is impaired. You could think brilliantly. I mean, we know there are plenty of brilliant people who are not God followers, but you might think brilliantly, but you're not going to necessarily think truthfully. Our reason is flawed. He said our hearts can have a pull or attraction, desire toward one thing, but our mind might know that such an attraction shouldn't be acted on. And he said sometimes our mind seeks to justify the decisions of our heart. He says our minds matter in this transgender debate because it's the mind that processes the experiences of people who have gender dysphoria. He says in a world that's broken by sin, we can't be sure whether our mind's reasoning is valid. See, I think that's just crucially important. That's such a good point that he's bringing up here. He uses an example in the next section. He calls it, can a man change his height? He said there's a viral video that you can look at from 2016, and it shows a young Caucasian man in his 30s. He interviews college students at an American university to show you what happens if you follow transgender ideology to its logical conclusion. So he asks, for example, he asked students questions. How would you respond if I was to tell you I'm a woman? Now, remember, this is a guy, Caucasian man. He says, how would you respond if I told you I'm a woman? And here's some of the responses he got. Good for you. I'd be like, what, really? I don't have a problem with it. Next, he says, okay, what if I claim to be Chinese? Now, remember, this is a Caucasian. What if I told you I'm claiming to be Chinese? Here are some responses. I might be a little surprised, but I'd say good for you. Yeah, be who you are. Somebody else said, well, maybe you had some Chinese ancestor. Here's another one. I would have a lot of questions just because on the outside, I assume you're a white man. Then the next question. I love this one. What would you be happy if I claimed to be 7 years old and I wanted to enroll in a class for seven-year-olds? So there's a lot more hesitation. But one student said, I probably wouldn't believe it, but, I mean, it wouldn't really bother me that much. I wouldn't go out of my way and tell you you're wrong. And somebody else says, if you feel seven at heart, then so be it. Good for you. Then lastly, here's the last question. The interviewer says, what would you say if I told you I was 6 feet five? Now, the guy is not 6 feet five. He's under 6 feet. Student one, no answer. Student two, I would question that. Interviewer says, why? Because you're not. I don't think you're 6'5". Student three, if you believe you're 6'5", I don't think it's harmful. It's fine. It doesn't matter to me if you think you're taller than you are. Interviewer, so you'd be willing to tell me I'm wrong? No, I wouldn't tell you you're wrong. One student said, no, but I don't think you are. Isn't that interesting? And it goes on that way. And it says, if you decide the only reasonable course of action is to affirm every feeling about self-identity that someone has, that's a blind alley. It leads to absurdity. It's dangerous. The argument that you have to, you know, in the transgender debate, the argument is if you have to accept the claim. If a man identifies as a woman, that he's really a woman. But he said that works backwards as well and could be a problem. Would that be kind? I think this is powerful. Would it be kind to tell someone who has anorexia that their self-perception of being overweight, that's correct because that's how they perceive themselves? In other words, do you say to them, hey, good for you. You think you're anorexic? You think you're too fat? Yeah, go on a diet. I'll help you. I'll make sure you don't eat much. Well, no, they're dying because they're too thin. So would it be kind to tell someone who feels their life is not worth living that they should act on what their head and heart are telling them? In other words, commit suicide? No. They said that would be cruel. That would not be kind. Yeah, exactly right. Well, there are a few more things in the chapter, and I think I'll stop at this point. But what a powerful book, God and the Transgender Debate. And I think that's such a wonderful way to ask a question of somebody. Is that kind to take somebody, for example, who's anorexic, feeling that way, and agree with them, say, yeah, I think you are too fat? No, because they'll even go on a more horrendous diet of some kind and die from that. People have died from that. Would it be kind to say to somebody who's feeling really depressed, yeah, you're right, your life isn't worth living. Here's a gun. Here are some pills. No, you get them help because their mind is a problem and you want to fix that. All right, so that's the book, God and the Transgender Debate. Plenty more to say about this, but I'll stop at this point. And have a good day, and we'll do another podcast soon.